We Made This. Welcome back, everybody, to the Movie Palace. I'm your host, as ever, Carl Sweeney, and thank you for joining me again for this episode, which is the fifth of our Summer of Psycho mini-series. And today we're talking all about the shower scene, infamous, the notorious shower scene, of course. And I'm delighted to be joined by returning guest Darren Mooney today. Hey, Darren.
Hey, how's it going, Carl? How are things?
Yeah, not bad at all. And it's been, you know, we've talked a few times fairly recently, haven't we? We talked about The Aviator, we talked about White Heat, and now Psycho. I mean, that would be an interesting triple bill, I think, wouldn't it?
In terms of queuing up movies, certainly, I think. In terms of, like, your classic Hollywood film history as well, yeah. And we're also, too, I think, hopefully, with a bit of luck, we'll be talking about Hugo at some point soon as well, not to tease too much too far down the line as well.
Yeah, that's true. That'll be a bit of a tonal shift, won't it, from this one.
From this, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's good to have you here, though. It's good to hear. It'd be really interesting to hear what you had to say about this film. The shower scene. So it's an interesting one, just devoting an entire podcast to the one scene. But I think it could be very worthwhile. But let's start more generally, I guess, Darren. Just your general thoughts on Psycho, really. Yeah, just as simple as that. What do you make of this film?
Yeah, I mean, Psycho is one of those movies that I can remember seeing for the first time. I mean, there are a lot of movies that, you know, I kind of absorb passively and kind of I'd seen before I remembered forming opinions of films and stuff like that. And arguably, you could say that Psycho is one of those in large part because you've seen so much of Psycho before you've seen Psycho, as it were.
Yes.
And I remember the first time I watched it going, oh, that's what the Simpsons were joking about then. Yeah. Which is one of those great things when you watch classic movies. I had the same thing watching Sorcerer as well, where it's like, oh, that's what Mr. Plow was kind of mocking. So I remember specifically about Psycho is that, and I may have told this story on here before, so I apologize for boring listeners with it twice, but a lot of my cinematic education, particularly when it comes to inverted commas, classic films. Now, to be clear, when I say classic films, I tend to mean films of the 60s and 70s and 80s. So perhaps, you know, retro classic films are sort of the post-classic films in terms of the Movie Palace, came from my grandparents. Because what would happen is I grew up in West Africa with my parents because there wasn't a lot of work in Ireland. They had to go abroad. They had to work abroad. So when we come back, we'd end up staying with my grandparents and mom and dad would have to go and see their friends and they have to catch up with stuff. And being honest, probably just wanted a break from the two of us as well. So my grandparents would kind of take charge of us for a couple of weeks every year. And part of that was that watching these old movies that Grandad had recorded off the TV. And that's how I saw, for example, a lot of Wes Craven movies, a lot of John Carpenter movies, The Shining, a lot of The Devil Rides Out, a lot of Hammer horror and stuff like that. And what I remember about Psycho was that it came years later when after my granddad passed away, when I was living with my gran when I was in college, because I'd begun to kind of pay attention to a bit more kind of classic film directors and Hitchcock in particular. Yeah. And I'd wanted to watch a couple of Hitchcock films. And I mentioned this to my gran. And Gran was very, very excited about this because she would have remembered those films. She would have gone to the cinema to see them when they were released in Ireland and had a great deal of affection for them. So we watched actually a couple of them. And what I found was really, really interesting was that my Gran tended to gravitate towards the more kind of playful ones, towards ones like North by Northwest or To Catch a Thief, which are kind of these delightful, isn't it great hanging out with really pretty people in beautiful surroundings, like holiday, practically holiday films, if Hitchcock made holiday films. And what I found was interesting was that I had almost the opposite reaction, being like a 20-year-old guy. I was like, no, I want the stuff that's a little bit grittier, a little bit edgier, a little bit more intense. And I remember my gran actually watching Psycho, still being freaked out about it, almost, I think at that stage, 45 years after it was released, and being impressed myself with it, because it's a staggeringly well-constructed film. It is one of my favorite Hitchcock films. Again, I'm hesitant to say what my favorite Hitchcock film is, because I suspect, like a lot of guests on here, it probably changes depending on what day you ask me or which one I watched last. Is it Rear Window? Is it Vertigo? Is it Psycho? It's probably one of those three.
Yeah.
I think Psycho is the one that stayed with me most. It's the one that I have kind of the greatest deal of affection and appreciation for. And it's the one that I probably watch the most, which is like the very kind of cheeky but honest way of gauging which one's your favorite. It's not which one can you intellectualize the most. It's which one have you actually sat down, watched and got sucked into the most times. If so, that's probably Psycho. For me.
Yeah, great stuff. And let me give you, just before we actually turn to the shower scene, let me give you a quote from Hitchcock from his interview. I always refer to this this book on the podcast, the Hitchcock-Truffaut interview.
Yeah.
And Hitchcock says to Truffaut about Psycho, "It wasn't a message that stirred the audiences, nor was it a great performance or their enjoyment of the novel. They were aroused by pure film." So I've always thought that was an interesting quotation. What do you make of that? Pure film. Do you think that's an apt description?
Well, it is. I mean, it's very much an example. And again, like, you've probably talked a great deal about how Psycho came about, how Psycho was produced. The fact that Hitchcock actually couldn't get Paramount to agree to finance it and so had to basically produce it as an independent film, raising the money himself. It is arguably pure film. But it's also a showcase in terms of how you make a film. And in particular, in terms of, not just in terms of narrative construction, in terms of story, in terms of theme, in terms of plot, in terms of pacing, in terms of that old kind of Hitchcock chestnut we're probably going to talk about, you know, the suspense story. Whenever you mention Hitchcock Truffaut, you have to get to this idea of suspense. But even in terms of like basic mechanics, and again, this is when we talk about the shower scene, because the shower scene is one of the defining scenes in cinema. It is a scene that you have seen countless times. Even if you've never actually watched the film, you've seen it reiterated, you've seen it replayed, you've seen it restaged, homaged, parodied, played with, you've heard the soundtrack, you know the shots almost shot by shot. And again, there's a wonderful director, Alejandro O. Philippe, who produces like documentaries. He's done a lot of documentaries, several of them about like classic films. And I think it's 7852, which is the one that he produced about the Psycho shower scene. Because obviously this, and we'll get into this in a moment, but it contains, you know, 78 setups and 52 cuts. And he said that, you know, there is cinema before the shower scene and after the shower scene. And it's a sequence that really defines or kind of reshapes how the audience watches the movie. And it does that in a number of kind of interesting ways. It is very much a cinematic showcase. It's something that I think you could only really do in this medium. I mean, Hitchcock joked about, you know, it's not the novel, the beloved novel that people were drawn to. And Block himself has all but conceded that. Block has said, look, you know, this is an industry where everybody runs towards success and runs away from failure. But, you know, my book was just one part of what happened. You know, it was Hitchcock's direction that arguably made it. It was Hitchcock's construction of the film and understanding of the film and understanding of the audience's relationship with the film that really sold it. And again, the fact that it's packaged as a film, I mean, you probably, again, talked about this, but the fact that you couldn't arrive late into Psycho, you had to watch it from beginning to end. Hitchcock instructed cinemas not to let people in late, to bolt the doors after people came in. So you really were quite literally locked alone in a room with this piece of film watching it, which is an incredibly intense experience. Of course, it's also great marketing because it means that the next screening is queuing up outside waiting for press to take photographs. But again, I think it is. I think when Hitchcock says it is pure film, like, it absolutely is. It's a story, it's a kind of a, it's a, an experience. And again, to use that cliche to sound horribly kind of, you know, prone to hyperbole, it is an experience that I don't think you could replicate in any other medium. And I mean, again, we'll probably talk again, there's some stuff to talk about Saul Bass and his involvement in the sequence. There's some stuff to talk about, you know, stuff like other adaptations, like the comic book adaptation that stages this sequence over 27 panels. And you can try and replicate it in that, but it just doesn't work. It is pure film. So I think when Hitchcock says that, he's being, you know, Hitchcock was not a man prone to false modesty. I think he's being entirely accurate here, though.
Yeah. Well, what I think we could do here then is, instead of me asking you for like an overview about this particular scene, I think there are a lot of interesting aspects of it. And I think we can maybe try and take some of them in turn. So let's give that a go. Like you said, it's a scene that's the subject of a lot of attention. In addition to that documentary, which I haven't seen yet, I'll confess, but it sounds great. And there's also a book just about the shower scene. Philip J. Skerry in 2009 wrote Psycho in the Shower. The basic idea being that it's a scene that helped to tip cinema in a certain direction in the last half of the 20th century. First question, and it might sound like a silly question. What do you consider to be the start of the shower scene? Where exactly in the film are we talking about here? Where does it start?
No, this is a very fair question, because when I think about the shower scene, I think obviously about the actual editing and technique itself, the bit where she actually goes into the shower and climbs into the shower. But when I think about it in narrative terms, it goes back a little bit further. It goes back to the sequence of Norman lifting the sort of the painting, which I think is Susanna and the Elders, which again, we might talk about in a moment. But it's him lifting off the wall and kind of peering in through the hole and getting that shot of his eye, even though the shower isn't running yet, even though at that point, you know, Marion is just sort of stripping down into black lingerie. And again, we'll talk about that and the symbolism involved in that in a moment as well. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of interesting where it is hard to kind of pinpoint where the sequence starts in terms of what you're talking about. But I think if we're talking about the film itself, if we're talking about the structure of Psycho, as in Psycho as a narrative, Psycho as a story, I think it begins with the taking down of the picture. I think if we're talking about the shower sequence as an entity of itself, it probably begins with the turning on of the tap and the getting into the shower of Marion yeah. Crane. That said, I think it's much clearer where it ends. It ends with that wonderful long take, which admittedly is briefly interrupted for a shot of the showerhead, because apparently Janet Leigh swallowed, or something. Yes, she swallowed in shots. They had to cut away to the showerhead. But it's really masterful. You get a slow pan up from her dead body over to the money, and yep. then back up to the house. And then the sound of Norman screaming and coming running out the door. And that sequence that ends it is arguably, it's a much stronger, much more dynamic kind of cut than when it begins, because it's a moment where the film goes, you are literally not watching the movie that you thought you were watching. Mm-hmm. And in fact, arguably, you know, if in the context of, you know, we talked about it as a movie, as a sequence that changed cinema, you are not watching a medium that you thought you were watching.
Yes, that's the thing. Yeah. And also, it, you know, it's a moment when the film then almost tries to switch your allegiance, doesn't it, as well, yeah. which is very interesting too. In that book, which I mentioned, and I haven't read it in full, I have skimmed through it today, but Scarry argues that to view the shower scene as a discrete sequence in its own right, you should start from the part where Marion is sitting at the desk totting up the expenses. So, I mean, it's debatable, I think. We can certainly go back as far as you mentioned as well. The murder sequence alone is 40 seconds and 34 shots long. I think that's one of the other interesting things, is like the number of shots that constitutes a scene is debated, and you see all these different figures and all that. It's fascinating. But let's back it up to the book. So what Hitchcock tells Truffaut in that interview is that the suddenness of the murder in the shower in the book is basically the only thing that appealed to him. So without that scene being in Block's novel, it's very unlikely he makes the film. And Joseph Stefano, the screenwriter, also says that Hitchcock told him the exact same thing. So let me read you the shower scene from the novel of Psycho, Darren, which I haven't read yet. I'm intending to read it very soon. But I have got the relevant quotation here. So Marion is called Mary in the book. So here we go. So Mary started to scream, and then the curtains parted further and a hand appeared, holding a butcher knife. It was the knife that a moment later cut off her scream and her head. So from that very brief description there, can you see from that why Hitchcock would have been attracted to putting that on film?
It's interesting, because I'm not entirely sure it's the scene itself that is kind of what draws, or what is the attraction there. I think it's more the genre context. Transition, the context of it, the fact that it is so jarring and so sudden. I mean, you read that out there in less time than it would take to actually watch the really frantically edited, really intensely edited sequence in the yeah. film that we're discussing. So it's very much like literally out of nowhere. And a hand appears, it's holding a knife, it cuts off her scream and also her head. Yeah. It's very kind of economical and very, you know, pardon the pun, sharp. And I imagine, like, again, without Hitchcock going too much into it, I think that's a large part of why he was drawn to it, but I think it's a large part of why it works. And it works, you know, in ways that are both big and small. In the big sense, what you have in Psycho, and it's something that I admired the first time I watched it, and as I've come back to it, I've loved it even more and more, because, and it's ironic because it's almost reverse. It's almost kind of a reverse example of how you would expect it to work now. Because, you know, now the part of Psycho that everybody knows is the shower scene. The movie seems to almost spill both backwards and forwards in time from the shower scene. You know, yeah. you're watching it and it's like there's the part of the movie before the shower scene and there's the part in the movie after the shower scene. That's how you approach it as a modern audience, even if you've never seen it before. And it's almost hard to imagine what it must have been like being an audience member sitting down to watch this movie,
yeah.
where it begins as something that is recognizably close to a film noir. It's a story about, you know, this affair, this very seedy affair that Miriam's having with this man who won't marry her, and how she's kind of trapped in this situation where she'll never actually be as respectable as she wants to be. You know, she has this moment of crisis. She takes $40,000 away mm-hmm. and she goes on the run and on the lam. She's very intensely chased by a police officer. And again, you have this sense of kind of suspense that's running through this. Again, Hitchcock's famous description of suspense. And again, he mentioned it in Hitchcock Truffaut. He's mm-hmm. also mentioned in interviews with Peter Bogdanovich. Everybody knows it, so I'll keep it very brief. But he's talked about surprise is when, you know, people are sitting down and have a conversation at the table, all of a sudden they blow up, and you get 15 seconds of shock there, and it's terrifying, and it's horrifying, you're like, what the hell happened? But it's only 15 seconds. As a director and as an audience, you deserve more. So what you do instead is you have them sitting at a table. You have the camera cut to a bomb ticking away underneath the table. Yeah. You have the camera cutting to a clock on the wall behind them, showing how time is moving as they're having a conversation. All of a sudden, what was dull becomes interesting and engaging, and mm-hmm. the audience is very much invested in that. And what you have with Psycho is in the first 40 minutes, you have a suspense setup. And the suspense setup is Miriam going to get away with this? And again, the film is very much structured around that. You have the police officer following her. You have her checking for the police officer. You have her buying the car. You have her worried about the cops maybe finding her. And then the shower scene arrives. And the shower scene is surprise, but it's all the more effective because it's surprise that comes from, in the context of Psycho, absolutely nowhere. You thought you were watching a film noir or something adjacent to a film noir. Instead, you're watching what we would now classify as a slasher film, although that term didn't really exist at that time in question. And again, you have this kind of sense of everything being upset and everything kind of thrown out, and the movie that you're watching not being the movie that you thought you were watching, and it radically altering and kind of skewing everything around that. So I can kind of see why that would draw kind of Hitchcock in a big picture sense. And again, arguably, one of the reasons why Psycho has resonated in the way that it has. Because again, like The Apartment, which was released around the same time in 1960, you can almost like trace the moment at which, and again, it's not actually the moment at which the 50s gives way to the 60s, because it's always easier to define these things in hindsight when you have decades that you can define as kind of archetypes and cliches. But it's almost the moment that you can look at and go, well, America is going through a very significant change. You are all of a sudden leaving the safety and security of the Eisenhower era. And by the way, small touch that I absolutely loved, the fact that Bates Motel was cut off from America by the building of the highways, which would have been a big Eisenhower kind of 1950s America pushing forward kind of thing. But you have it kind of then giving way to the uncertainty and chaos of the 60s. And again, you know, this is one of those things where it's much neater in hindsight than it is at the time. Obviously, stuff like, say, civil rights and Kennedy's assassination and Vietnam wouldn't happen until much later in the decade. But you kind of, when you're watching Psycho, you can feel like that stuff is kind of percolating in the background. The world is suddenly a lot more complicated than it used to be. Ironically, the world is suddenly in color as opposed to black and white, despite the fact Hitchcock chose to shoot Psycho in black and white. And also The Apartment as well, I think, was it the last Best Picture winner in black and white until The Artist? I think there's some trivia like that around The Apartment, possibly.
Yeah, I'm not sure off the top of my head, but that sounds plausible, so we can go with that. Someone will correct us, I'm sure.
Comments, and it's entirely my error, and I apologize for that if it is. But yeah, you have that sense of like the shower scene somehow coming to embody all of that. It's the moment at which, bam, the world that you thought you were living in all of a sudden isn't that world at all. The movie you thought you were watching isn't that movie at all. The rules and the expectations that you have about how stories are structured, how stories are told, how movies are supposed to unfold are all thrown to the wind because a hand reaches through a curtain with a knife and cuts it short horribly. And again, part of me wonders then, you know, in terms of more specific stuff, did Hitchcock read that sequence and go, I could make that scene work on a shot-by-shot basis, on a mechanics, you know, on a kind of a cut-for-cut basis? Because again, I don't claim to be an expert in this. I'm not presenting myself as such. But one of the interesting things that you read and that you see a lot of commentary on, and particularly from other filmmakers and particularly from editors, is that like Psycho was a moment at which the editor of the film, and in this case, we should single out George Tomasini, became much more important in terms of being seen as a creative force in shaping and guiding a movie. Because it is, those 40-odd seconds of footage are just a barrage. Even now, watching today, you know, at a point where the average shot length in American cinema has gotten ridiculously short, that sequence still seems like an incredible, forceful barrage of imagery just being thrown at you. I can't imagine, you know, what it was like in 1960, when the average shot length was much longer, when audiences had a much more standard expectation of kind of how shots were going to be framed and how scenes were going to be paced within that, and the idea of kind of going from masters to close-ups back to masters, primarily in order to disguise edits within the sequence. The use of editing, the powerhouse kind of sledgehammer approach here, on a populist film is just dazzling. There's a real sense, even watching it, of it being like, wow, this is an emotional gut punch. This is a physical gut punch. And so, yeah, I can kind of, part of me wonders if when Hitchcock read those couple of sentences that you mentioned there, that he, on a mechanical level, was like, yep, I can close my eyes and I can see almost cut for cut what the scene is going to look like. Or whether it was that broader point that I kind of made where it's like, no, it's a film noir, but then something happens and the world is chaos.
Mm. I think it's possibly a combination of all of those things, you know, because it's easy to say after the fact, but I think Bloch's writing there, you can definitely see the potential to develop that situation through montage. Or I imagine that's what Hitchcock could see. I think the suddenness of the event that you mentioned is pivotal too. And just the fact that, you know, I think it's a naked woman, there's a knife involved. I think there's some very obvious things there.
Yeah. Again, Hitchcock, great director, fantastic publicist.
I was wondering, there's lots of stuff to break down there from what you were talking about. So you talked about the sort of shock this must have been, or the gut punch this must have been for audiences in 1960. And I think that's absolutely true. Like, I don't think it's any coincidence that on the last episode I recorded, for instance, I was speaking to Brandon Brown. He's doing a documentary on Bernard Herrmann. But he was saying, like, look, if I could go back in the time machine to see any film on opening day, it would be Psycho. And I think on the very first of these Psycho podcasts I recorded, I said basically the same thing. You know, it's either Psycho or it's the train arriving at a station, I think, in the 1890s. I think it's clear why people say that kind of thing. So do you think this scene, to what extent is it kind of contingent for its effectiveness on that broader narrative scenario? Because it comes at a point when our identification with Marion is particularly high, doesn't it? Or to what extent does it stand apart? Because like you have sort of alluded to, it's a scene that people talk about in isolation. It's a scene that's parodied in isolation. So I don't know. What do you think?
In terms of context, and again, this is something that's kind of interesting and something I've always personally found interesting about how it's positioned and how it's played, is that it works on, and again, this is that horrible critical cliche, it works on multiple levels, but it does actually work on multiple levels, where if you're going in blind and you suddenly have this kind of gut punch genre shift of like, well, it's a film noir, now it's a horror film, get with the program. And that kind of shocks you in that front. But even if you go in with the knowledge that this is a horror film, there's something deliberately and pointedly uncanny about it, something inherently wrong. And it's something that I've been thinking about a lot since I first saw it. And I think it's largely down to the nihilism. And it's the nihilism of the larger film, but the nihilism of the sequence itself, which is Miriam, in terms of horror movie language, typically what happens is a character, and again, this is something if even horror movies themselves are aware of this. Yeah. Stuff like, say, Joss Whedon's Cabin in the Woods goes into this in a great deal of depth. But in order for, you know, horror movies to work, there's an implicit moral judgment in there in a lot of them. And the moral judgment is very simple. The idea is that audience members who are going to watch a bunch of very pretty people get sliced up don't like to feel too bad about that. They don't like to feel complicit in it. They don't like to feel uncomfortable about it. So what you do is you impose a rigid moral framework on it that allows the audience, even subconsciously, to justify the killing. So the idea is that in order to be brutally murdered, the characters in question have to transgress. They have to do something wrong, something that marks them as worthy of death. And again, it's typically something that's very puritanical, something that's very conservative. In the horror movies of the 70s, films like, say, Halloween, for example, it can be something as simple as having sex.
Yeah.
It's that sort of thing. But even within that, it's a very kind of structured rule. The idea is you break the rules and you are punished for it, and the audience gets to watch you being punished for it, and the audience also gets to feel less bad about watching you being punished because the natural order is being restored. What's interesting about Psycho, and what I find fascinating about Psycho, is the extent to which it, with, you know, even before that had been codified, seems to deliberately and pointedly subvert it. So you have Miriam, who takes the money. She takes $40,000. That's the transgression. That's the point at which, you know, theoretically she has committed the sin that should allow her to be punished within the, you know, the logic of horror stories. Like, so she's done a bad thing. Therefore, when something bad happens to her, we should all feel, well, hey, you know, it's terrible, but she kind of deserved it. The way the film is structured, Miriam actually has a change of heart. And again, it's kind of interesting that you have this juxtaposition. I mentioned the black lingerie. It's notable that Miriam's introduced wearing white, so white bra and panties in that hotel room. And again, the last time we see her wearing anything, she's wearing the black bra and panties in a motel room to create kind of a nice symmetry there. And the black, you know, kind of, again, those cliches of kind of black and white morality, the idea that she has in some way been kind of dirtied by this, that she has in some way been compromised, she has done something wrong. How and ever, the film is structured so that she has this big moment of realization. She has this moment when she's with Norman and she goes, oh, I've realized I'm in a trap. I'm going to turn around. You see her doing the maths to figure out how much of the money she'll have to replace, the $700 that she paid for the car, working out how much she owes. And the sense in which she's realized that she's done bad and she's going to go and try and make it right. And if you look at, say, books written about, you talk about books written about the shower scene. If you look at books like Alfred Hitchcock and The Making of Psycho, Janet Leigh actually quotes Alfred Hitchcock, you know, describing the shower as a rebirth, as, you know, a sort of a baptism, so to speak. You know, she's restoring her kind of virginal purity. She's being washed. She isn't just like, and I think that the metaphor Hitchcock uses is like washing the smell of a guy out of her hair. No, she's actually properly, thoroughly, spiritually cleansing herself. And so to have that moment of purity, that moment of, in theory, redemption, that moment of kind of purification being the moment where the knife appears, where she's brutally murdered, where she's struck down, represents a kind of a rejection of any sort of moral structure on the story whatsoever. Because it's no longer she did a bad thing and she's being punished for it. It's she did a bad thing. She realized she did a bad thing. She tried to make it right. And then the universe just decided to rain down, you know, stabs upon her. And therefore it kind of becomes more unsettling as a result of that. And again, you have that even within the shot, you have that wonderful, and again, it's a dissolve. And I think it was Terry Williams, who was an assistant editor working with George Tomasini. He said that it was a 12-foot dissolve, as opposed to a 4 or 6-foot dissolve, which would have been the standard at the time. It's a nice long dissolve, but it's a dissolve from the water and the blood, which is actually, I believe, Hershey's chocolate sauce, spinning down the drain, cutting or fading slowly to her eyes, to Miriam's eye, as she lies there dying on the floor. And again, it's this wonderfully brutal cinematic visual metaphor, which is there's nothing. There's just darkness. There's just an abyss. We're all circling a drain. And again, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, I know Block has said, look, a lot of what makes Psycho great is not me at all. It's notable that Block was one of the disciples of H.P. Lovecraft, who again was one of those great American horror writers. A large part of it is this idea that and again, without the racism, I should be absolutely clear, but the idea that this world is kind of built on a foundation that is constantly moving and erratic and chaotic and beyond human comprehension, that the world doesn't work in ways that we expect it to, that it doesn't follow laws or patterns or it isn't governed by rules and regulations, that there are forces at work that we don't understand and that are terrifying for that. And in the end, all there is the great abyss beneath us. And that's what I think works about the shower scene in the context of the movie, because not only does it represent that in terms of Miriam's journey, it also represents that for the audience, because again, it's that idea that, you know, you're watching a movie and you expect a movie to adhere to a set of rules in terms of genre conventions, and then it doesn't. And what's interesting about the shower scene in hindsight, because it's almost impossible to watch the movie without knowing it, is the idea that it exerts such a strange gravity, where the movie itself seems almost kind of anchored in that moment. And again, watching Psycho, I think watching it for the first time was a very surreal experience, because the shower scene is the scene that everybody knows, and it arrives about halfway through. And so you have a big stretch of the movie leading into it that I had never seen before, never thought about before, never talked about before. And a big stretch afterwards, where the only thing that I knew about the movie was that Norman was actually his mother. Everything else was entirely new to me as well. And it's kind of really strange, because you have almost the exact opposite effect that you imagine watching it for the first time would have been back in 1960, where the genre conventions of the first half are fairly straightforward and fairly understandable and exist within the framework of like an Alfred Hitchcock film or a film that you're going to pay to see in the 60s versus this strange, horrible thing that happens in the middle that completely changes everything. And then a second half, which is a bit odd and a bit macabre and a bit weird. Whereas, you know, watching it from a modern perspective, it's almost the exact opposite, where it's like, The first half is a bunch of stuff that I had no idea was in this film, and it's completely different from everything I expected the film to be. Then there's the shower sequence, which is pretty much shot for shot exactly what I expect it to be, because it's been so ruthlessly and so mercilessly and so lovingly parodied. And then the end of the movie is rather strange, because I didn't realize that these were supposed to be major characters at all. So it's kind of interesting that you have, like, watching it now as compared to watching it then, it's almost the weird inverse effect, where it's not that it's lost any of its potency or impact. It's that because the shower sequence has become what it is, it's taken on an almost opposite level of impact, where it's still powerful, it's still dynamic, it's still affecting, but it catches you off guard in the exact opposite way that it would somebody sitting in a seat.
It's really interesting, that idea, that it kind of represents kind of a boundary or something, you know, and I think we can get more into that now. Lots of interesting stuff there. Like, you mentioned the idea of, like, just chaos intruding in the world. And I think that's very Hitchcockian, you know. I think even if we talk, you talked a bit about things like North by Northwest representing a big tonal shift from Psycho, but even North by Northwest, which I think is the film he made directly before this. But there you have, you know, Cary Grant is just out at a, whatever it is, like a club or whatever. Somebody mistakes him for somebody else, and he gets embroiled in this whole cross-country adventure, you know. So I think that idea of, like, and you can see in Hitchcock films like The Birds, I think, and so Rear Window, I think, as well. So it's one he's interested in. And also, just, I think it's one of a number of Hitchcock films that puts a man against a woman in a violent or potentially violent incident. So things like Dial M for Murder is a comparable sequence. Obviously, the difference here in Psycho is that a first-time viewer probably thinks it's a woman-on-woman attack, so it has kind of a different inflection, of course. Okay, yeah, that thing you were just talking about there about Psycho is kind of a boundary. So you've talked a bit about that in sort of cultural terms as well. You know, what came before Psycho, what came after Psycho. And in cinematic terms, too, I think it's relevant, isn't it? You know, I think it marks a boundary between the classical era that came before it, and it's kind of also a bridge to more contemporary cinema, isn't it? You know, I think Truffaut in that interview suggests to Hitchcock that Psycho is oriented towards a new generation of cinema goers, and Hitchcock readily agrees, I think. So do you know what I mean in that kind of sense?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And again, it's kind of, it's interesting in terms of kind of Psycho, that you have this discussion around, and it's something that happens quite a great deal with horror, where you have this discussion of, is this a horror movie? As if saying it's a horror movie might devalue it in some way. It's kind of interesting that when people talk about, say, the origins of kind of the slasher movie, you see a lot of discussions of kind of, you know, oh, well, the first slasher movie is actually Halloween. And people go, no, it's Black Christmas. It was a couple of years earlier. You're way off base. I find it interesting that very few people will actually go, no, Psycho is transparently the first slasher movie, even though I think you could probably make that argument. He says very gingerly and aware that I am not the person to make that actual argument. I know. Well, again, like the cinematic language of it, the arching back of the knife, the use of the violin and the scare chord, the way in which it's shot, the way in which you have the pairing of sex and violence, which, as you pointed out, is very much a kind of a recurring Hitchcock motif. And again, we can talk about stuff like Hitchcock's fascination with strangulation, which also brings together that idea of kind of the erotic and the kind of like really sinister and violent together. But you have the idea of kind of them being all brought together in a way that is meant to be like horrific, scary and unsettling and downright creepy in a way that it isn't in his other work. And which I think you could position as like one of the, you know, forebearers of the current kind of slasher movie. I think that Philippe makes the same case himself in kind of like, you know, 7852, where he argues that like one of the legacies, or perhaps the biggest legacy in terms of cinema, in terms of Psycho, was that it kind of opened the floodgates in terms of this wave of violence against women. And particularly like for violence that, even if it wasn't explicitly graphic, and I mean, we'll probably talk in a moment about how explicitly graphic or how cleverly edited kind of the shower sequence is in Psycho. But like the idea that all of a sudden Psycho created this kind of marketplace where you could stab women repeatedly and you could focus on their death and you could focus on their suffering in a way that maybe you couldn't entirely beforehand. And again, I find it interesting to look at something like, say, having recently rewatched, I think, Orson Welles' Touch of Evil, which in many ways feels like a weird proto-Psycho. I think I watched it with my podcast husband, Andrew Quinn, and he joked that it's like, I remember writing down repeatedly, Psycho homage? and then realizing the movie was made 2 years earlier.
Yeah.
But it very much, like, you can see a lot of the stuff was percolating in the subconscious, but I think that Psycho really kind of crystallized that.
Mm.
Psycho kind of really brought that all together. And I think that, yeah, if you want to be very precise in terms of, like, you know, sort of what its influences are, I think it birthed an entire genre of slasher movie in a broader sense. And again, I'm, you know, hesitant to speak as an expert in cinema and inverted commas, but again, looking at those comments by people who are directors, people who are editors, saying that, you know, it did make editing much more important in terms of film construction and in terms of scene construction. The editor was seen as a much more potent creative force after this happened. But even, I think you're right in terms of audience expectations afterwards, because I think that audiences were kind of thrilled by this, or kind of like, I can see audiences coming out of this going, being really energized by it and kind of wanting something, you know, kind of, you know, something more like this, more cinema like this. And again, it's notable that you can see stuff bubbling through the kind of consciousness around the same time. It's notable that, is it Michael Powell?
Mm-hmm.
You know, of Powell, yeah, and Pressburger, like one of the most kind of classic cinematic institutions, classic old style studio system Hollywood, produced Peeping Tom in 1960 as well, which is similarly very similar to Psycho in terms of dealing with themes like voyeurism and themes of violence. But that didn't resonate with audiences. That kind of arguably ended up kind of forgotten or overlooked for quite a great deal of time until it went back and people kind of reassessed it and looked at it. So it's interesting to wonder about Psycho in terms of how Psycho managed to, and apologies for the Bernard Herrmann pun, but managed to strike that chord with audiences, as it were. And in terms of that audience divide, actually, I think that's kind of something I kind of alluded to when I talked about watching it for the first time, because I remember I really liked Psycho and my gran was still I don't know if horrified is the term. I don't want to make it seem like she's kind of like stuck in the mud, yeah, or kind of overly conservative or overly old-fashioned or overly precious. But I think my gran was still a bit more uncomfortable with it, which is,
yeah,
again, remarkable in the context of, I talked about, like, we would watch, you know, Wes Craven and John Carpenter movies, which are much, much, much more graphic than this.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, there was this sense of this being unpleasant for her. In a way that those movies aren't. And I wonder if maybe that was a memory of having seen it, or whether it's because the movie kind of does that thing that you mentioned where it kind of straddles that line.
Yeah.
Because it starts like something else. It starts like something recognizable and then morphs into something that is much more uncomfortable and much more weirder. Does that feel like a violation? And again, like, again, you know, not to reference particular takes too heavily, I think Peter Bogdanovich spoke of it as a violation. He talked about coming out of the cinema having watched Psycho and feeling like he had been assaulted.
Mm.
And I think that, you know, maybe there's an element of truth to that. Maybe that's maybe what my gran was kind of responding to.
Yeah. Something ironic that this is the film, or this is a film that makes you feel as if you need a shower because it's so unsettling, isn't it?
Well, I think, was it Janet Leigh joked that she couldn't take that, she really didn't like taking showers?
Is that right?
Again, well, there's so much apocrypha around this.
Yeah, I want to come on to this. Yeah,
yeah, I'm sorry.
No, it's all right. Yeah, I was thinking about the boundary. I mean, the code, the production code is still, oh, yeah, in place at this point, of course. It still kind of struggles on for a few years. I think it's until 1968, but this is clearly at a time when the code is weakening, isn't it? Because, not just because of the shower scene, but, you know, things like, isn't this said to be the first film in which we see, like a mainstream film, in which we see a flushing toilet, for instance?
Absolutely. I mean, the joke is that, again, Hitchcock himself had trouble with the production code administration on the Paradine case from 1947. Yeah. And part of me wonders if, like, the inclusion of the toilet in the shower scene, because it does happen, depending on if you want to go for that extremely liberal definition of the shower scene,
yeah,
it happens within the shower scene, the flushing of the toilet, yeah, with the kind of notes going down in it. I do think, is it Janet Leigh had the prop master actually install a fake toilet in her trailer so that she could have a picture taken of her reading the script while sitting on it, because she realized how important it kind of was in the context of kind of getting away with this stuff. Yeah, it is. Yeah, in terms of boundaries, in terms of Hollywood, that's actually, it is. And again, it's weird that, like, we talk about the violence and it's like, actually, it was the toilet. It's very, a much more symbolic illustration of kind of how Hitchcock was breaking with the past.
Yeah, and I don't think I noticed until I got the Blu-ray that toilet seat actually seems a bit discoloured as well, doesn't it? Which is kind of appropriate, I think, given the kind of drabness of the overall scenario and all that.
I mean, Norman's not changing the toilet seats every Monday.
No, not like the linen, yeah. So yeah, just this broader sense that it's pushing up against these social taboos around things like hygiene and nudity as well. Because in that book I was kind of leafing through, the book I mentioned on the shower scene, He talks about how the frontal shots of Marion in the shower are arguably the most daring presentation of the female body in the history of American cinema up until 1960. And what he's basically saying is it's part of a broader continuum. You know, the fact that Playboy had launched in 1953, the fact that the Kinsey reports were around the same time. So this scene you can take as kind of a symbol of the growing acceptance of explicitness in popular culture as relates to violence, but also around issues of sexuality, for instance, as well, which is kind of fascinating, I think, too.
Well, I mean, it is worth noting that, again, Lee's double in these sequences was Marley Renfro, who I believe was a Playboy model. She's 21 years old. And again, she's talked about how there was no modesty on the set, because Hitchcock himself apparently had one of the reasons why it took 7 days to film this was because they had kind of the body cast for Janet Leigh when she was shooting, and it would take hours to get into it and hours to get out of it and to let it dissolve properly. I think it's a mole cast is what they called it, or something like that, a mole suit. But it was Renfro would talk about how when she was doubling for Leigh, she would just wander around with nothing but a little vanity patch covering her pubic hair. She'd just be wandering around on set. And again, you have people like the editors and people like the script editors and people like the writers and kind of, you know, people working on the production talking about the weirdness of working on the shower sequence where Marley Renfro would be like sitting down for coffee with Alfred Hitchcock in nude, wearing yeah, absolutely nothing at all, and Hitchcock just being like, well, this is apparently perfectly normal. And again, you have that kind of sense of taboo there as well. And again, it is that mingling of sex and violence, because it is the penetration of a nude woman in a space that is incredibly intimate and confined, in a space that is seen as being, you know, domestic, even though in this case it's a seedy motel. And you have that juxtaposition of sex and violence, even outside of kind of like bringing things like, you know, penetration and the knife as a kind of a phallus into it, because Marion was introduced in a motel after a sexual encounter. And again, you have this idea within the film itself, that discussion of kind of shifting sexual mores, where, you know, you have this discussion about, will she be able to bring him home, you know, to the photo of her mother and, you know, with her sister for dinner? And the idea of kind of like, is respectability something that's even possible? And like the idea that, is America changing on some level to the point where, you know, this kind of seedy motel stuff doesn't really matter anymore, where what happens in seedy motels doesn't or shouldn't alarm us as much? I mean, because again, you have that juxtaposition where, you know, they talk about how even married couples now will spend a couple of hours in a seedy motel together. You know, this sort of sense of, well, is our social mores loosening? Is this, you know, is America becoming more relaxed or more liberal?
Yeah. And I think that's fascinating because you mentioned the opening motel scene, and I've always read that the same way, that a post-sexual encounter scene. And I was just looking at the BFI book on Psycho by Raymond Dergnat, and I didn't realise until I looked at that audience members in 1960, there are a few plausible ways they may have read that scene. Ooh. So as a post-sexual encounter scene, or the fact that heavy petting, quote-unquote, might have taken place, or just because of the conventions of cinema up until that time, there may have been audience members who just thought, well, it's a heat wave, and that's the only reason why they've stripped down, you know?
I kind of love that. It's like they were having coffee and he spilled some on her blouse. So the only right thing to do was to go to a motel room and just have the conversation in there while she's lounging around in her bra.
That's kind of what I was saying to Tony and Marlene on the earlier podcast, was like, the thing with the code was, I think there was a rule at one point that if you had a scene with two lovers on a bed, both of them had to have one foot on the floor at all times. You know, but by the time this film comes along, obviously the code is weakened and it's not quite as strict and all that, because it didn't seem like they had 1 foot on the floor at all times. Right. So what about just on the technical, pure technical level? So it's a great achievement, I think. It's a scene that's rhythmic and relentless. And I think it's this idea like the form and the content are in harmony, because we get these kind of alternating POV shots, don't we? From the mother and from Marion. And I think that speaks to what the film is about to do, doesn't it? I.e. swap out its protagonist and start to shift our identification. But just so much, I mean, there's so much to pick up on there. Like the fact that after the attack has occurred, Hitchcock's camera puts us right on the floor of the bathroom with Marion, doesn't it? It creates this kind of parallel between what's taken place to her and us, you know. So I think there's a lot going on there. And I think it's such a fleeting scene, it's possible to overlook that, perhaps.
Oh, it is. I mean, again, it's fantastically well constructed. Again, the famous story about Hitchcock, you know, going to the censors, showing them the sequence, them demanding cuts, him going back with the exact same sequence, having made no cuts whatsoever, yeah. and calling their bluff in determining what the difference was. Again, that kind of story of the fact that the question of whether or not you can see any penetration with the knife, or the knife actually touching flesh. I think for one brief second you can. And I believe the speculation is that was accomplished using reverse footage. So they had the knife on her stomach and then pulled back, reversing it, as it were. So to avoid any kind of blunt force trauma or any unfortunate impact, or like revealing the knife as rubber, or any of those potential special effects failures that you might have if you tried to do it in the sequence. It is absolutely dazzling. And again, it creates that idea. It's that idea of kind of like what you imply, and the idea that the audience kind of populates the negative space, the gap between what you actually show and what you're kind of relaying to the audience. And again, arguably, you mentioned that idea when you read the sample of the text, which is very economical, very efficient in terms of language. But this idea of kind of then populating all the details around it in your imagination, you know, the question of whether or not Hitchcock could visualize the final scene from those couple of lines of dialogue or a couple of lines of sort of text. Like, even within that, you have this idea, again, of making the audience complicit, because, you know, we don't see the knife go in. The knife goes in our imagination. We fill in the gaps with that quick cut, that quick, you know, sort of blast of information kind of thrown at us. And again, it's that idea of perspective that you mentioned, the idea that, you know, the film is going to switch from, you know, Miriam's story to Norman's story. But what's interesting about that is, because of that rejection of the kind of moral framework that I alluded to earlier, that idea of, you know, punishing the bad girl and there being an implicit understanding from the audience that's okay, what Psycho does is kind of slightly more uncomfortable, because it's like there is no validation or justification. There is no sense of, well, Miriam was a bad girl and she's getting punished and therefore we shouldn't feel bad about enjoying it. Instead, it's like, no, we are explicitly being placed in Norman's shoes. Yeah. And again, you know, recurring Hitchcock theme, this theme of voyeurism, you know, obviously in movies like Rear Window, but even the way he positions the camera. The opening shot of the film, to pick an example, where you have the camera panning across Phoenix and then seeming to hone in on Miriam's window, like some sort of angry god singling her out for what's about to happen.
Or like a bird, you know, the fact that we're in a place called Phoenix, this is a character called Marion Crane, and that, also that swooping camera movement. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah.
And also then the stuffed birds in sort of Norman's study as well.
And the copper kind of looks through the window. He kind of has this kind of bird-like posture too.
Like in America, it could be played by Sam Eagle from The Muppets pretty much. But you have again this kind of sense of this idea of us aligning with Norman, but us aligning with Norman in a way that is deliberately and pointedly uncomfortable. Like, again, my favorite moment in Psycho, and it feels really weird that I'm talking about the shower sequence for so long, and I'm like, that's not even my favorite moment in Psycho. But my favorite moment in Psycho comes a couple of moments after the shower sequence, which is the moment where Norman's getting rid of the car, where he wants to bury it in the swamp. And he pushes it in and it starts to sink under, and then it stops for a second. And in that moment, and I remember it clearly because I remember feeling it the first time I watched it, I remember feeling it the second time I watched it, and I remember still feeling it on occasion even though I catch myself. You're like, oh no! They're gonna catch him! What's he gonna do? How's he gonna get out of this one? And it's a really uncomfortable moment because you're like, yes, I am actually rooting for Norman to get away with this, even though I know how horrible what he's done is. Even though up until a moment ago, I was invested in Miriam's story. It's like, no, the film has so effectively switched over and so effectively implicated me and made me complicit in what Norman's doing that I want him to get away with this, that I don't want him to get caught. And it's absolutely dazzling. And I think that's very much kind of part of what it does. And it's notable within the shower sequence itself. Again, Hitchcock breaks a lot of the rules of, you know, inverted commas, cinematic grammar. You know, things like, for example, he breaks the 180 rule as well, repeatedly throughout the camera, constantly cutting across that 180 line, which, you know, should theoretically disorient audiences, but actually Hitchcock does it well enough that it really, really works. I particularly like the juxtaposition of the moment early in the shower sequence where she's showering and you've got this wonderful negative space in the top left-hand corner of the screen and the door opens. And, you know, and the mother comes in, or Norman comes in. And again, it's one of those great moments where the audience is complicit because you're watching it and you're like, I know that that negative space is there for a reason. I know it's going to be filled with something. And then you juxtapose that. There's a moment after that, towards the end of the sequence, where you get that shot reversed. And you have Miriam now in the bottom right-hand corner of the shot against this. And again, so much of that sequence is so beautifully constructed. The tiles, the wonderful kind of bathroom tiles, which give you that grid. And again, I part of me is like, am I thinking about this too much? Am I giving it too much credit? But this idea, again, of having boxes and rules and boundaries and the idea of like spaces within which you expect things to behave as they're supposed to do. So these little kind of perfectly square tiles up against the wall and this sequence of Miriam kind of slinking down along them and that negative space this time being left empty. This time being left completely vacuous, which is, you know, unsettling of itself as well. It is absolutely dazzling. And again, that sequence at the end where after you've had this really frantic kind of, you know, sequence, 52 cuts or however many cuts you want to call it, you then have this kind of masterful long shot and this wonderful kind of camera movement that literally does what you're talking about there, where we're with Miriam in her dying moments. We're there when she takes, you know, arguably we're not there when she takes her last breath due to that very selective edit and cut to the camera head. But we're there as she's dying or as she's died. And the camera then kind of guides us through the room. And I love that it brings us over to the newspaper with the money in it, as if to say, this not really important now. Don't really bother with that. I know it got motivated the plot up until this point, but that's not really what we're interested in anymore. And then kind of guides us out to the house. And then, as you point out, from that moment onwards, it's like we're with Norman pretty much. And it's a dazzlingly masterful kind of piece of cinematic storytelling, I think.
It is. I love that. And I love, you mentioned the dissolve, the transition earlier from the plug hole to the eye. It's hard to think of a more evocative, almost kind of banal representation of life just kind of draining away, you know. So yeah, I totally agree. Right, we've mentioned some of the kind of myths and apocrypha about this shower scene, so I thought we could delve into that a little bit more. So what I'll do, I'll fire a few of these at you, and then you can add anything or just, you know, respond to whatever you wish to. So you've already mentioned this first one, actually, the idea that Hitchcock didn't direct the scene, actually Saul Bass did. From what I've heard, that kind of, maybe that comes from the fact that Bass had created extensive storyboards for the scene. But I know that lots of people working on the film have vigorously contested the idea that this scene had nothing to do with Hitchcock. So that's an interesting one. And a similar one is that, I don't know if you've heard this one, but that a German crew had actually shot the scene. And that's why it kind of has this Eisensteinian approach to montage. Have you heard that one?
I have heard that one. That again is one of those great, you know, while this was groundbreaking and shocking, it was so groundbreaking and shocking that even American film crews couldn't possibly make it. I believe he actually worked with a TV crew on it as well, which helped with kind of speed things up and help get the tempo of kind of the movement up. Because again, if you're a TV production crew as opposed to a film production crew, you're used to shooting quickly and editing quickly and again, working on it. I do kind of love that fact because it gets at the myth of Psycho. It's arguably more revealing of the kind of the myth of Psycho than it is about Psycho itself, because it tells you how radical people saw Psycho as being, how they imagined it being so transgressive that you had to actually like literally import foreigners to make it because it was such a ticking time bomb. It's one of those great kind of myths which has no basis in reality, but also somehow reflects how, you know, the memory of a thing works.
Yeah, it's the old Mr. John Ford thing, isn't it? It's the man who shot Liberty Valance, I think. The idea that when legend becomes fact, print the legend or whatever it is, you know. Yeah. Or alternatively, the idea that a lie gets halfway around the world before the truth gets its pants on, you know, that kind of idea. I do know, by the way, that Sergei Eisenstein is Russian, before anyone picks me up on that.
Yes.
I know that whoever spreads the myth maybe relates that to German.
Well, I mean, again, kind of, well, European foreigners, basically. Yeah. And again, this idea of German expressionism and the idea of so much of kind of American art form and cinema evolving kind of east, you know, easterly.
Yeah, so one of the other myths is that the film was originally shot in colour and that it was ultimately decided that the bloodshed in the shower scene was too unpalatable to an audience to be seen that way.
Well, I mean, the Hershey's chocolate sauce probably wasn't that convincing in colour.
It was
always shot in black and white, I believe.
Yeah, well, and then there are all these things with conflicting accounts too. So the idea that Janet Leigh's stand-in isn't seen at all in the shower scene is said by some, but however, Hitchcock tells Truffaut that it's only Leigh's hands, shoulders and head that are seen. The rest is Marley Renfro, who you've already mentioned. The idea that you can see Marion's nipples, or alternately that you can't. Now, I believe, I looked at the shower scene sort of almost frame by frame today. And you mentioned as well the idea that you don't see the knife go in. I think there are 3 frames where you can see the knife go in. I wasn't aware of what you said about the reverse, doing it in reverse. I wasn't aware of that.
Now, keep in mind, I don't have a source for that. I've seen it printed several times, but it's possible. It's possibly just apocrypha. But
possibly
it's
fits into this too.
Yeah, it's also possibly, I think, just speculation.
On the nipples, I think there are a couple of shots where you can see them as kind of, but they come across as kind of dark smudges. So I think from behind the shower curtain, and then there's a shot of the hand on the shower curtain.
Yeah, that's definitely Renfro, I believe.
Yeah, so there's that. Have you heard the story about how the stabbing sounds were created for the film?
Melons!
That's one version of the story, yeah.
Sorry, that feels like a rather awkward segue from nipples, but anyway, I'll let you feel this one.
Let me navigate us out of that one. Okay. Yeah, there is that story that they were achieved by utilizing melons. An alternative version of the story is that they were created by thrusting a knife into a slab of beef. And in the beef version of the story, which I think the source for that is an interview with Danny Green, who was the sound editor.
It's probably verifiable, yeah.
So yeah, that's probably got a chance of being close to the truth. But what he said is that the meat was then taken home to his wife, who made a nice roast out of it. So there's something kind of dryly comic about that, which appeals to me.
So that kind of reminds me a bit of, again, this Alfred Hitchcock shared universe, of the kind of story from Alfred Hitchcock Presents Lamb to the Slaughter, which I think was directed by Hitchcock. I know it was written by Roald Dahl, but which features a woman who beats her abusive husband to death with a frozen lamb shank, and then cooks the lamb shank and serves it to the police officers investigating his death. I kind of love the idea that Psycho has this kind of almost true version of that, where you have this beef that's implicated in some sort of vague, horrific cinematic crime/trauma, but ends up being kind of eaten quietly at the end of the day with nobody any wiser.
Yeah, I think Lamb to the Slaughter is actually included as a bonus on the Psycho Blu-ray. Oh. And I think that maybe is why, perhaps.
Worth a look. I recommend that, actually, if you have the Psycho Blu-ray.
I haven't seen it, so I will check that out, yeah. The last myth I think I wanted to put to you, the idea that Hitchcock ensured that cold water was used to get Janet Leigh in the right frame of mind. However, Leigh herself has said that was nonsense, and it was just part of the spiel that was kind of thrown out on the Universal Studio tour, you know, when they were taking people around. So that's kind of, that's interesting, I think. Have you heard any more, Darren? I mean, those are the main ones, I think.
Yeah, those are kind of the main ones, I think. Again, the Saul Bass one is kind of interesting because it's such a strange one to make because it's so roundly and rightly ridiculed. Again, you know, Bass is kind of like, he's a hugely influential figure. He's a figure who is kind of recognized and celebrated, and particularly now, for his contributions to cinema. And I think it was around about Phase 4, which is his own film. And if you haven't seen Phase 4, I would wholeheartedly recommend seeing it. I can verify that he did direct that one. And it is very good. But it's kind of, I think it was around the release of Phase 4 that he began giving these wild statements in the British press claiming that he had directed it. And again, that's fundamentally absurd given that, you know, Hitchcock talked to Truffaut about how what brought him to Psycho in the first place was kind of wanting to direct that sequence in particular. So it's kind of strange and weird. And it does kind of get to the sense in which, you know, Saul Bass, kind of the way in which those storyboards are important and the way in which kind of like, you know, so much of the editing can be seen as being storyboarded and so much of it is like kind of structured like that. Okay, so, you know, you can see that maybe Bass has some claim of authorship in a vague sense on the scene, you know, not exclusively, not even in the majority of cases, but a small sense of authorship. It's kind of weird that he ballooned it himself up in the way that he did. In terms of other kind of apocrypha and other stuff that I've heard that I think is worth noting, I believe, and this is fascinating to me, but that Hitchcock's original notes for the film specified that he didn't want music playing during the actual sequence, that he didn't want music playing during the infamous shower sequence. And Bernard Herrmann himself came up with the idea of saying, well, what if we try it with this? And again, ends up being one of the most iconic music cues in cinema history. And again, I kind of love that you have this kind of nice sense of kind of, you talked about the idea of Psycho being a kind of, and the shower sequence in particular, being a line in the sand that's like, there's before and afterwards. But I love that you can see the influence of, say, that score on John Williams on Jaws, for example.
Yeah.
And then Hitchcock actually worked with John Williams on the score of Family Plot, his last film as well, which feels like a nice kind of bit of symmetry and kind of, you know, tying it all together, which I really like as well.
Yeah, I can confirm that last piece of myth to be true about the idea of Hitchcock, because Brandon Brown, who I spoke to about his documentary about Herrmann, he sent me a picture of a memo he's looked at for his film, which is Hitchcock's instructions to Herrmann about, it's very specific about when the music should kick in and in what scenes. And I think this was a memo from January of the year they were producing the film. And of course, you know, it didn't go that way. And we ended up with arguably the most recognizable music cue in film music history. You know, I think you say Psycho to people and they make a stabbing motion in the air and they shriek. Yeah, exactly right. So interesting, yeah. Like I spoke, you were talking about your experience of watching the film with your nan, but I was saying on the last podcast, I showed this film to my son who's 12. So he's probably a bit young. I will concede that. But I wanted to see, to kind of gauge his reaction. And he knew about, I don't know how, he knew about the shower scene going in. And I've never told him about it. His mother's never told him about it. I very much doubt any of his friends are talking about Psycho.
On the schoolyard, you never know. This is...
You never know. So he's picked it up from somewhere. But he thought that a man died in the shower scene. So he knew that we were watching the shower scene play out. He still wasn't expecting the murder. Anyway, just a couple more things quickly before we go, I think. One of the ideas Philip Scarry refers to in that book is the idea that the shower scene specifically and Psycho generally helped further solidify the idea of superstar directors, which would then become more important over the years. So I'm just kind of wondering what you think about that, because I suppose we know, of course, about Hitchcock's reputation for self-promotion. So I think there's something to that.
Absolutely. And again, it's worth noting that kind of, you know, Hitchcock was one of the cornerstones of the auteur theory as it kind of emerged from kind of Cahiers du Cinéma, was it? Andrew Saris, am I remember correctly?
Yeah, well, and Truffaut wrote an influential essay and all that.
But kind of that movement kind of has its cornerstone in the idea of Hitchcock as a director with a strong stylistic sensibility himself. And again, we talked on, you know, both your podcast and mine before about the way in which kind of directors were treated, you know, before that, kind of during the 30s and 40s in the studio system, where they're seen often as hired hands. And where you would have, like, you know, we talk about projects like iconic projects like The Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind, where you almost have directors kind of cycling in and out, where they're just realizing kind of the studio or the producers' vision of what the film is supposed to be and serving kind of very much as hands on a conveyor belt. And again, I think that, you know, while, you know, perhaps again, Hitchcock's tendency towards self-promotion means that he tends to not so much kind of be elevated as push his way to the front of the crowd. You know, I think that you can kind of see that. I think that you can kind of see that as a logical or kind of reasonable extension of it. And I think that you wouldn't have like 70s Hollywood without that sense of auteurship or that sense of auteur as an important kind of way of approaching cinema or looking at cinema, studying cinema, and ultimately as a result making cinema. I mean, I'm reading Scorsese on Scorsese at the moment. He's talking about how, like, one of the big things for him coming through, you know, studying film and kind of studying film production was the idea of recognizing that people like Hitchcock weren't just hired hands, they were artists, and they were artists working in pulpy capacities, doing things that were, you know, seen as being trashy and kind of tasteless, but they elevated it to an art form, and that it was worth, I think that Scorsese specifically cites, he doesn't cite, say, Psycho, for example, but he talks about looking at things like, say, the Westerns of the 50s, and as younger critics, like critics like Truffaut or like Saris, kind of realizing that those have value, like, you know, and are worth celebrating and worth examining as the work of an artist's hand rather than just as a piece of disposable entertainment. And again, I kind of wonder if maybe that's too much to put on Psycho. I think, again, when I think about Psycho, I think more about the editing. I think, again, of George Tomasini, who worked with Hitchcock, I think, on Rear Window, Vertigo, North by Northwest, and The Birds as well. Mm-hmm. And I think about that in terms of kind of influence, in terms of kind of like shaping the films that follow, or shaping how I looked at films.
Yeah. Yeah, I do think the idea of like the promotional gimmickry, which put Hitchcock front and center, is very interesting, though.
Oh, yeah, the advertisement, the trailer,
Yeah. Just in terms of this idea of the superstar director, because I think often, I mean, it's a trend that continues. Isn't it a way of like understanding a film, or you think you understand the film before you see it because of your awareness of the person who's behind it? Yeah. So it would apply to someone like Hitchcock. It would apply to someone like Tarantino. Just the idea that I don't like his sensibility, for instance, so I don't want to see his film in a negative sense or in a positive sense. I dig this, what this guy's got to say. So I'm there, you know, I'm queuing up for that. That kind of idea.
Yeah, that probably makes sense. Yeah. And again, Hitchcock, again, the master of kind of self-promotion, giving all these interviews, doing all this press and kind of making sure, again, like it's the kind of thing that you still see today. And you see it with things like, and to pick small examples, like Christopher Nolan, ironically, of all people, who kind of has this, this, you know, depiction of himself as being this icy, cold, disconnected individual. But when you watch how he manages his publicity and his press, it is incredibly self-aware and self-conscious and, you know, in Vertigo, become as playful if you happen to have a particularly wry and dark sense of humor. So this idea that kind of Nolan cultivates this image of himself who drinks tea out of a flask on his film sets because he's so ridiculously British. Or he gives press interviews where he's like, oh, I had never heard of Harry Styles before I cast him in my film, despite the fact that he has, I think, two teenage daughters, which makes not knowing who Harry Styles was in 2017 highly, highly, highly unlikely. But even things like the way in which he presents himself as a champion of kind of film and cinema and kind of, you know, of film stock and the theatrical experience, the way in which he kind of, you know, arguably, I think Dunkirk, that the argument is that Dunkirk was sold on Nolan's name more than anybody else's. So yeah, you do have this idea, I think, of the kind of director as a marketing force, as a creative force, as a personality that imprints himself on his work. I mean, Hitchcock famously, like, literally branded himself over his work. You know, the image of himself in silhouette becoming basically kind of like something equivalent to a Coca-Cola logo during his productions.
Yeah, and the cameos. And all right, so what about, you mentioned some of these parodies and some of these recreations of the shower scene. Tell us about this comic book, then, because I'll confess I'm not familiar with that one. Tell us about that.
I don't actually remember this. I don't remember it that well. I remember reading it at some point when I was going back through archives. I think around the time I was digging into the independent comic scene in the early 90s, when during the comic boom, you had various publishers who were trying to get in, trying to get a slice of the cake that traditionally belonged to, say, DC and Marvel. So you would have like Topps Comics coming in and doing the X-Files, for example. And you'd see comics that were adapting kind of films, whether new or old, and releasing them. So I think this was a 3-issue series, and it's quite literally, it's when you read the shower sequence in it, I remember it, it's very much like looking at the storyboards, which again kind of gives that sense of kind of how the scene is structured. And it's interesting because when you have the still images next to them, you can see how important it is for it to be a film, if that makes sense, for it to be something that is dynamic and moving and cut, and something which you can't control as an audience member. Because when you are reading a comic book, you can control the pace at which your eye moves over the imagery. Now, again, if you're a very good comic book artist, you can also then play a metagame and control the pace of the audience's eye movements across a page by shifting things like, you know, the location, size, and relationship of the panels. You can guide an audience member's eye through a page. But intrinsically, reading a comic book as a, you know, as a spectator, as a reader, you have much more control over how you process the information than you do if you're sitting in a seat watching a film. And what I remember about reading that comic book was it illustrating to me how that works, because I can effectively pause that comic book sequence and stare at a sequence of Marion with her mouth agape, kind of reaching out. Whereas, you know, or I can examine that frame in depth and see if the knife is piercing her flesh. Whereas when I'm watching it, and again, obviously, you know, Hitchcock didn't make the film at a point where people had home media and could pause and could go frame by frame, as, you know, you've done, and as, to be honest, I've probably done as well, going through the sequence and like looking at each image in crystal clear high definition to see what is and what isn't and how it fits together. So, but it did underscore to me reading that comic how differently that sequence played in one medium that would logically be quite close to film, or would come closer to film than I think prose does. And in that kind of illustrated, you know, how much the sequence works in film more than any other medium I can imagine.
I just wanted to mention one other recreation of the shower scene, which is that I've just finished watching Bates Motel.
Oh.
I think I mentioned on a previous episode that I had seen up to the beginning of the fourth season. And I kind of, that kicked me into high gear, and I've watched the rest. It runs to 5 seasons. And midway through the 5th season, the events of Psycho come into play with Rihanna playing Marion Crane. And I don't want to say exactly what happens in case anybody wants to go out and watch Bates Motel, because I'm aware it is something that people look forward to and it's in the final season. But it was very interesting to see how they handled that. They were obviously very aware that the viewers were expecting a scene of Marion Crane in a shower. And they decided to do that. And I'm not going to tell people how they resolved that scene, but it was a very interesting take on it. Have you seen that series at all?
I have not, actually. Again, I only have so much time. I don't get to watch that much television. Yeah. And I think that when Bates Motel was on, I was kind of like, I have space in my schedule for one kind of like weird reinvention of a classic piece of serial killer pop culture. So I'm watching Hannibal, yes. Which was kind of unfortunate. But not unfortunate, because I absolutely adore Hannibal. Hannibal's one of my favorite shows of the 2010s. Yeah. But I do think that it kind of squeezed out. It made Bates Motel something that was less important for me to catch. And I do think that as I recall with Bates Motel, and I apologize to any Bates Motel fans that I may be baiting here, but I do recall that while the reviews for later seasons were great, were actually really, really great and actually got me interested in the show, I think initially there was some perception that the first season or so maybe took a little while to get off the ground, and that maybe kind of cooled my interest in kind of diving on in, I think.
Yeah, now my impression was similar. Somebody gave me the box set, I think for Christmas. I hadn't asked for it, it was kind of unexpected. And I probably, if I'd have been watching along as it aired on television, I probably would have bailed out maybe after the first season or during the first season. But the fact that I had the box and the fact that I'd heard similar, that it picks up, I stuck with it. And yeah, my impression was that the final two seasons are very good. It progressively gets better from the first season onwards. Good. So I think, and it's, we're talking 10 episodes a season here, so 50 episodes in total. Manageable. It's manageable. It's not in the Hannibal League, but it's, you know, as a similar-ish kind of series, it's pretty good, I think, yeah.
Well, very few shows are in the Hannibal League, to be fair.
This is true.
I bet it's beautiful, though. I bet, like, you wouldn't want to eat anything there, but you want to just, like, appreciate how wonderfully constructed the Hannibal League is.
Yeah. And I think, well, I think the main thing is that I think Freddie Highmore gives a very valid portrayal of Norman Bates, and I think Vera Farmiga is very good in the series, too. So it's an interesting one for the acting. Now, Darren, it'll be interesting to find out if we think similar about Gus Van Sant's Psycho in the future, because you're going to be joining me again on the Summer of Psycho to talk about that film, which I'll confess I'm really looking forward to that recording. I don't want to say why, but it's going to be a fun one, I think.
It is. And again, yeah, we talked about references and homages. So yeah, I think maybe that'll be a nice kind of bridge into talking about Gus Van Sant's Psycho.
It's got to be done. Yeah. All right, Darren. Well, before we go then, is there anything else you wanted to say on Psycho? I think we've chewed over the shower scene pretty extensively here, to be fair. But yeah, anything else? Go for it.
No, it's still fantastic. I still absolutely adore it. And I know everybody's remarked on it before, so it's a bit of a cliche. But I've come around on the psychiatrist who shows up at the end of the film to explain everything to the audience members. I kind of love his enthusiasm. I love his energy. I love that clearly he's been waiting to explain how multiple personality disorder works to somebody, anybody, for the entirety of his career. And so he's like, I'm not going to waste this. There's a beautiful moment where I think, is it Miriam's sister asks a question. He's like, no, you're wrong, because. And I'm like, well, this is completely unprofessional, but I really like this. So that's kind of like, you know, kind of my the part of my attitude towards Psycho that has evolved most strongly, you know, since first seeing it, is going from, boy, that closing sequence is terrible and heavy-handed and corny and ill-judged and completely unnecessary and condescending to the audience. And it's kind of evolved to, yeah, but at least he's enjoying himself, so let's let him have it.
Now, I've already mentioned this anecdote on, I think, two previous episodes here, but were you aware that Hitchcock apparently went up to Simon Oakland, the actor who plays the psychiatrist, after he shot that scene, and he said, thank you, you have just saved my film. And it's really strange, because that's the scene everybody kind of attacks. If you look at, like, Roger Ebert's review and various other things, that's the one people single out for like, the most vicious criticism. Yeah. So
it's one of those things like, you know, like Heat, where, you know, after the fact, Al Pacino came out and said, look, it got cut. The movie was long enough. They had to cut some fast. So it turns out Vincent Hanna had a massive cocaine addiction. And that explains a lot of his characterization. Part of me wonders if, like, there's an extended cut of Psycho where, you know, Hitchcock cut the fact that right before the kind of psychiatrist came in to offer his opinion, he was like, I'm going to snort this whole big bag of cocaine. It's medicinal, right? It's medicinal.
On that note, and I'm looking forward to seeing it. I can't remember who plays the psychiatrist in the Van Sant version. Is it Robert Forster? I know he's in it. I can't remember if it's him. Can you remember?
I can't remember. Well, it's ironic because whenever I watch Gus Van Sant's Psycho and I watch Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho, somehow I just literally transpose everything except a scene of Vince Vaughn masturbating in black and white starring Janet Leigh.
Robert Forster, I can confirm, is Dr. Simon in the
remake. Anyway, that's we'll talk about this. A very different energy, I imagine.
I think so. Let's park that discussion. We want to come back to that. Darren, where can people find you online?
Oh, yeah, you can find me online. I'm on Twitter at Darren_Mooney, where I'm constantly tweeting about movies and other nonsense. You can follow me at The Movie Blog, which is my blog that I operate, where I write reviews of new releases and occasionally some classic stuff as well. And I co-host a podcast called The 250 with my good friend Andrew Quinn. We've been very, very lucky to have you on a couple of times, Carl. I think around the time that this is releasing, you will probably be joining us for a discussion of White Heat, yes. The wonderful film from 1949, which is very, very worth seeking out. And we really, really enjoyed that. And it was great fun having you on. We'll hopefully be having you on for our own Summer of Scorsese season. Although, being honest, the way things are going, it'll probably be like the Indian Summer of Scorsese. But we really hope to have you on talking about Hugo. Yeah. Very much looking forward to that.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that too. All right, listeners, I think we're just about done here for today. We'll be back with another episode on this Summer of Psycho miniseries very soon. I think I'll be talking to Andy Wolverton about some more of the production stuff around the film that we haven't yet got into in these episodes so far. So I'm very much looking forward to that. In the meantime, you can find the podcast in all the usual places, on Twitter, at Movie Palace Pod, on Facebook and Instagram. So that's it for today, listeners. I hope you can join me once more when the shower curtain rises once again at the Movie Palace.
Carl, you saved this podcast.
Elsewhere, and we made this. Frame to frame.
You've actually introduced me to Le Diabolique. You told me a long, long time ago how great it was and that I should buy it on Blu-ray. I listened to you and I did, and I never watched it until this podcast. I just didn't watch it, which is, you know, not great considering the film is phenomenal. And Vertigo, so my first exposure to it was through during my A-level film studies class, like you mentioned, on the wall. There was just the gigantic, iconic orange poster, and that sort of intrigued me to see what it was about.
We dig music.
Are they like Trekkies? Are they Modis?
Actually, probably not, because then people would think they'd support the Prime Minister of India.
I don't know if there is a term for Depeche Mode fans. I've not particularly heard one. Perhaps if our podcast hosting label mates from We Buy Records are listening, they can let us know. Paul on that podcast is a very big Depeche Mode fan, so let us know.
Yes, please. Yeah. Are you a Modi?
Yes.
Depeche.
Helen has just looked it up, and yes, they are Modis.
Pull or pass.
Whatever else you say about the Spawn film, the soundtrack is something else.
Yeah.
For people who don't know, who haven't seen the film, the soundtrack was essentially get really rather popular rock act and really rather popular dance act and make them mesh something together for said soundtrack. And do that 14 times.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.